Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs Kleine Formen.
So, this new project draws on a diverse archive. It's one that includes poetry and dramatic comedy, as well as the wide range of the early modern period's advice books. It examines the everyday ways in which early modern subjects sought to remake both human nature and the natural world. Those ambitions, I argue, are better understood not as projects of large-scale world-building, writ large, but as the accumulation and repetition of small-scale improvised techniques, like tricks, knacks, devices, recipes.
Welcome to a new episode of Microform. After a short summer break, we are back with a double feature that was created in collaboration with literary scholar Jessica Rosenberg during her MacArthur Fellowship at our research group Kleine Form. Jessica Rosenberg is an associate professor at Cornell University researching early modern literature and culture, history of science, plant studies, and book history. In her first book on botanical poetics, Early Modern Plant Books and the Husbandry of Print, she describes the reciprocal influence between plant forms and text forms in early modern print objects. For her lecture at Kleine Form in June 2024, she introduced us to her new research project with the working title Shakespeare's Second Nature, Tricks, Knacks, and the Remaking of Renaissance Worlds. In this lecture, Jessica described a genre of small epistemic forms from early modern cookbooks, medicine books, and books of secrets. She laid out how they taught people from the time period to do stuff with stuff. What follows is a commented recording of Jessica Rosenberg's lecture on the theory of the neck.
Revisiting questions that have been foundational to studies of the Renaissance since Burckhardt, whose Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy was published in 1860, I suggest that we rethink the axiomatic relation of power and knowledge, not through that larger scale history of concepts, but through an attention to these contingent and reusable tricks and knacks. And that's going to be my focus today, in particular on the latter. Accordingly, my method of proceeding begins with a close attention to the styles and textures of technique, and in particular to the literary and aesthetic forms assumed by technical knowledge. The book is specifically organized around pedagogical experiments and what I've come to call small epistemic forms, like the trick, the knack, the recipe, the device. As forms of skilled or cunning action, these informal and undervalued units of knowing help unfold everyday life, which comes at times to be seen as a kind of chain reaction strung together from these discrete skills, tactics, methods performed in a row. That's sort of how you make up a day from the beginning to the end. But they also, and this is one of the sort of more dramatic and surprising turns for me in this work, it's driven me to think a lot about the plots of theatrical comedies. I'm not a theater person, had not been a theater person, but I'm now thinking a lot about comedy, which is fun, so I'm glad to be doing it. But I think we can also think about the plots of comedies as anthologies of composite tricks, serially arranged, one after another after another. And it's those sort of atomic units as ways of knowing and as knowable things in themselves that link the wide variety of texts and contexts that this new project encompasses. And again, this is a very new project. I'm really eager to talk with all of you about it. And these are sort of my first forays into it. So I'm going to take my time today to focus on these English small epistemic forms, and most specifically on those words themselves, on their range of meanings, on the complex work that they do in early modern English culture. I'd like to begin with a particularly useful exemplum. The Oxford English Dictionary provides two 16th century examples for this, its third definition of trick, in this meaning a clever or adroit expedient, device, or contrivance. The first is from the 1573 edition of Thomas Tusser's 500 Points of Good Husbandry in a couplet that offers a method for harvesting beans. So he writes, "Gather the lowest and leaving the top shall teach thee a trick for to double thy crop." The second one is from Shakespeare's Love's Labor Lost and refers to some dick that knows the trick to make my lady laugh. The pairing of this farmer poet, Thomas Tusser, who is, to my mind, by my calculations, perhaps the most popular secular poet in 16th century England, but writes very practical farming advice throughout. The pairing of Tusser with William Shakespeare offers a helpful reminder of the proximity of practical and comedic techne, the value that both place on efficiency and brevity, on the play of instrumental reason in both, and on a good day on it, the happy yield of that instrumental reason. But both, moreover, as these two lines emphasize, turn on knowing, teaching, and learning, and not on mere performance, right? So it's, that shall teach thee a trick for to double thy crop, right? Some dick that knows the trick. Tricks aren't just things you perform, they're things that you know and that you learn. Then, as now, comedy had a close relation with practical knowledge through its fascination and reliance on technique, skill, and seriality, through its distinctive combination of cruelty and aspiration, and ultimately, and as I'll talk more about today, through its pragmatic reflections on teaching, learning, and knowing. So the rest of my talk today is now going to dive further into the lives of those small forms, and perhaps the most enticing, or at least the most fun to say, which is the knack.
Jessica's understanding of knacks as small epistemic forms brings her to some examples from the pop culture realm. Both the movie title The Knack and How to Get It from 1965 and the band The Knack and their 1979 album Get the Knack hint to the particularity of knacks that they can be taught, learned, and acquired. So it wasn't just in early modern times that knacks were understood as something that you get, put on, or carry around. This close connection to the human body and everyday usability risks getting lost when we talk about a theory of the knack. However, Jessica is interested in exploring how the knack pushes towards, but perhaps never reaches, the generalizability associated with theory. To dive further into the linguistic and lived realities of the knack, Jessica continues with a second object lesson.
Epistle to his 1576 translation of Levinus Lemnius's Touchstone of Complexions, Thomas Newton tells the story of a certain dapper fellow in the court of Alexander the Great who performs a trick that Newton describes over the course of several sentences as a bravery and ostentation of his cunning, a vain trick and thriftless device, a practiced knack and notable singularity, needless and frivolous trumperies, a peevish practice, and then finally an unnecessary matiotechni. I'll come back to that word in a second. The fellow's singular skill consists in his ability to throw a chickpea through the eye of a needle from a pretty distance off, and that many times without any missing. Alexander, in turn, rewards these curious devices with only a bushel of more chickpeas, so that he should not lose the hoped fruit of that his practiced knack and notable singularity. Acknowledging there's no useful end to this performance, right? He just keeps tossing chickpeas over and over and over. Alexander provides him with a bushel of means to continue to practice his knack. His chickpeas, in other words, generate only more chickpeas. So both the example itself and that final term are drawn from Quintilian, from his rhetoric, where matiotechnia, or vain art, comes third in a series of Greek terms for rhetorical abuse, following non-art, atechnia, and bad art, kakotechnia, which was my favorite. The example appears in other settings too. Just a few years after Newton's translation, in Montaigne's essay of Vain Subtleties or Subtle Devices, as it's translated in English in 1603, the chickpeas have changed to grains of millet, and Alexander has disappeared. Much later, in Hegel's Aesthetics, the anecdote reappears again, this time with a lentil, slightly smaller, as a figure for mere copying. The Dapper Fellow also makes a more recent appearance in Tsien Nai's Theory of the Gimmick, where Montaigne's version of this scene helps convey the non-systematic badness of the early modern proto-gimmick, as she calls it. The example she writes is a lot like the gimmick, but not quite. It matters, she suggests, that this language of aesthetic judgment did not yet exist. A complex vocabulary, though, and this is what I'll be diving into, did exist in early modern England for these kinds of judgments. And it's dominated by three terms in particular: trick, device, and knack, as I'll be going on today. These terms and the Brieger lexical network that they exemplify are not, like Nye's gimmick, the distinctive and symptomatically ambivalent product of late capitalism, but as shorthands for aesthetic, social, and technical judgment in the early modern world in which they circulated and took hold, they tell us something important about how these categories work. As small forms, they offer an exceptional window into what Nye describes in her more modern moment as vernacular practices of making judgments. So I began with this example because of what the Dapper Fellow's practice knack can tell us about what a knack can do. It can itself be a practice, a kind of know-how, an instinct, but can also itself be a kind of object and an offering, something with value that expects something of value in return. But that very value emerges in repetition, in those iterative rhythms of performance and practice, of the chickpeas that you keep tossing. Like many subjects of early modern comedy, Newton's Dapper Fellow makes an aesthetic experience out of technique. And the magic of that technique is playing on scale. I mean, how many of you in hearing this story are wondering just how small the chickpea is or just how big the eye of the needle is to make that work, right? I think that's part of the sort of hook of this as an example. And it also suggests, and these words are connected within this bigger early modern lexicon, to machinery, right? A device, a machine, is a small form, like a lever, that's able to sort of carry much more than its size suggests, right? It's able to sort of overperform itself. Knacks and tricks, too, even if they're not a mechanical contrivance, though they can be sometimes, they outperform their own scale. They're either more valuable or more powerful than their smallness suggests. And there's some economic and sort of practical promise there that they hold out, but there's also a lot of theatrical pleasure in the performance of surprise, of seeing something this small do something this remarkable. And I'll return to sort of the potential pleasures of that performance later on. So this is also one of our essential connections to comedy, which is notoriously a small genre about small people and for small people, which may be said more or less disdainfully, depending on who's talking about it. But it's also in a number of influential accounts of humor and how humor works, something that operates through the pleasurable performance of deflation and diminution, of taking people or things down to size.
Thus, bringing up Newton's chickpea anecdote allowed Jessica to touch on several qualities of the neck that she'll further investigate in her lecture. She outlines two basic points. First, the neck as well as the trick and the device are all forms that are partially action and partially object. They live on the boundary of work and thing, how Jessica phrases it, and therefore must be understood as a form between material and method. Her second point refers to a crisis of judgment that is caused by these forms. A crisis of judgment both of perception and evaluation. One might ask, what is a neck? Where are its boundaries? What does it do? And is it good for anything at all?
So on this first point, that a neck lives on the border between a work and a thing, what do I mean by that? It stands for an objectified technique or an artifact. A knack could be a device. It could be an object, a work of artifice, a toy or a trinket. It could be an edible dainty. A trick, likewise, could be a ruse or a method. It could be a trinket or a trifle, right? A small object. Device possesses a specially daunting conceptual range, and it could name anything contrived or designed, whether a mechanical engine and even a personal motto, that your own sort of impresa in that sense that distinguishes you from other people. But all of them, and this with special force for knack and for trick, imply a small and a graspable form. But as sort of the model of the mechanism or the mechanical device suggests, they're going to outperform that small scale. This compactness underwrites the value of Naxx in this early printed Book of Household Secrets from 1545, which collect many proper Naxx to repast the minds of them that love new fangles, of which you may count yourselves. With its printed title surrounded by all of these single spot ornaments, it itself emerges as a kind of knack or a new fangle, something made, something put together. It is itself kind of a confection in that way. And the collection's pretty conceits and proper knacks range from the sort of everyday skills, labor-saving devices, ways to do laundry, remove stains, to things that are more like magic or sort of DIY marvels, how to catch or kill mice, rats, lice, fleas, how to make that no dogs bark at you, how to know if a woman be with a male or female child, how to make hair grow, how to make hair not grow. But books like these also offered knacks for making knacks. A knack could be a little bit of sort of sugared fruit that you have after dinner, like a little treat. The fine knacks that you would decorate the table with after a dinner party. So the knacks are both methods and those small trifles. And there's some blurring between what the method is and what that actual physical object is, as discrete units of action and as objects of social and commercial value. Knack also carries this double valence when it appears later in that same decade. This is 1549 in Thomas Chaloner's translation of Erasmus's Praise of Folly. Here again, it's in the context of banqueting and hospitality. So this is in the Voice of Folly, and she's saying, for what else? What booted so many junkets, which is also in this category of little after-dinner sweets, so many junkets, sweetmeats, and dainties to balance their belly with all, unless the eyes, the ears, and the whole mind were also fed with laughter, sport, and merry conceits. And this is part of a sort of extended list of sort of after-dinner games you can play with your guests. And the next line is translated, but of all such knacks, I am the only deviser, right? Folly is the only deviser. Ego sum architectrix unica. So these are a devised thing here that are part of these after-dinner treats, but they're also like a game that you're supposed to play, a sort of set of tricks you're supposed to play out with your guests. And as Chaloner's use of device and deviser make clear here, those knacks are artifacts, they are made things, but they're again very much embedded in hospitality and in consumption. Knack here is translating this word tragomatum. A tragomata was originally a Greek word for also for those little sweet fruits treats you eat after dinner. So these are sort of small pleasurable luxuries that we're talking about here. So to extend Folly's claim here in this passage from Erasmus, calling a method or an action a knack or a trick performs an act of devising of its own. And this is what I mean by saying that the word objectifies a technique. For me, there's an important sort of media and material text angle here, which is that I'm interested in asking and looking at how these particular methods are actually rendered on the page, whether they're broken off as units of their own, are they appearing as islands of text, are they numbered, are they broken up into chapters? How do the resources of the page, because they do, how do they help these techniques seem like modular and valuable units unto themselves? How do you tell one from another? How does it become a sort of unit or entity? There's a visual life to that on the page. So these are distinctively small forms, as I've suggested, both as discrete units of action and as objects of social and commercial value. Often to call something a knack will devalue it while still marveling at its capacity as something still so small to do so much work. As such, these knacks are easily enchanted or enchantable. In Act One of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Aegeus' father accuses Demetrius of seducing his daughter with these cunning objects, bracelets of hair, rings, gauds, conceits, knacks, trifles, nosegays, sweetmeats, messengers, etc., of strong prevailment in unhardened youth, with which cunning thou hast filched my daughter's heart. So these rings and trifles are knick-knacks, but they're powerful ones, right? They carry with them this kind of operation, a capacity of strong prevailment on someone as sort of soft and impressionable as Hermia is. And in the art of love, art's power might reflect either the working of skill, Demetrius as a seducer here, or the enchanted operation of the object itself, that it could become a kind of magical talisman that could do that work. So by the same stroke, to call something a knack or a trick can also disenchant it. This is also glossing the seductive power of a knack. This is from a poetic complaint written by Isabella Whitney and printed in 1567 that's complaining about essentially the kind of methods of seduction of young men that they've learned from Ovid's Ars Amatoria. So, Ovid with his art of love doth teach them the same knack to wet their hand and touch their eyes so oft as tears they lack. So as unfeeling as those young men might be, right, they have this trick to give themselves sort of wet-eyed emotion, right? So they teach them this same knack. Ovid, a bit later in the 17th century, by a different writer, will be called the Grand Master of Love Knacks. The sense here suggests his mastery, his control over the work of seduction, but it also, I think, more specifically suggests that he is the schoolmaster of love, right? He is the one who has taught everyone how to do this. He has taught them the knacks of doing it, right? Both the knack and how to get it, to return to that sort of double point. You don't just have the knack, you also have the getting of the knack. So Whitney's evaluation of those suitors, her demystification, unveiling of their trick here, leads to my second and maybe predictable point at this point, but this is that the term, it attracts a crisis of judgment. If you're calling something a knack, you're wondering, do I recognize that it's a knack? Do you recognize that it's a knack? Is it worth something? Is it not worth something? And this uncertainty, in turn, vibrates around scenes of articulated judgment, around the performance of these judgments and the specific circumstances in which they're articulated. So in comedy and elsewhere, but especially comedy becomes especially useful for thinking about this, the capacity to make such judgments becomes a social qualification. To know a device when you see one or smell one, and to know its real value. Any time that you're looking at a comedic stage then or now, I think, no one is on the same page, right? There's a sort of discrepancy across everyone on stage in terms of what they see or recognize or know when it comes to a knack or a trick, right? Some people are in the dark and fail to judge it correctly. Some people are judging it correctly. That's sort of the stuff of comedy. So increasingly, by the end of the 16th century, to call something a knack or a trick is to claim that kind of knowingness for yourself, to devalue it or demystify it and imply that there are other people who believe in it still, who are kind of dupes of the knack.
To illustrate the crisis of judgment caused by knacks, Jessica refers to another example, the page layout in Reginald Scott's book Discovery of Witchcraft from 1584. As a collection of magic tricks, this book includes both instructions on how to perform these tricks and some margin writings indicating both the superiority of the performer and the deception of their counterpart. Going through the body text, readers get particular instructions to learn tricks on, for example, how to eat a knife and to fetch it out of any other place, how to make one dance naked, or how to draw a cord through your nose, mouth, or hand so sensibly as is wonderful to see. In the margin text, though, right next to the body text, the author describes the knowledge gap caused by the knack. Scott noted, for example, a common juggling knack of flat cozenage played among the simple, etc.
So this much harsher language of judgment appears in the margins, sometimes appears in the titles, but the body of the text is just telling you how to do it. And there's about 50 years later, there's a text called Hocus Pocus Junior that basically plagiarizes all of these chapters from Scott. Basically, all of the text is taken from Scott, but it skips the commentary. So it just tells you how to do the magic tricks. It doesn't include the judgment and the unveiling and everything that Scott's giving you. It's just, here's how to do it if you want to, you know, go to a kid's birthday party or, you know, perform after dinner or whatever it may be. But part of what I think is useful of seeing this on the page is that it sort of gives you this differentiation of where the space of judgment is in the sort of lighter Roman type and where the object being judged or being sort of demystified is in the black letter method. Okay, so I want to focus for the rest of my time here on a few examples from the theater of the same period. Several comedies beginning in the 1590s also described themselves and the kinds of pleasure and profit that they promised their audiences in the same language of objectified technique. Knacks and tricks by this period became part of early modern English comedy's reflexive aesthetic language, how these plays accounted for the kinds of things that they were. This is reflected in a group of comedies with titles like A Knack to Know a Knave, A Knack to Know an Honest Man, those are 1594 and 1596, but also A Trick to Catch the Old One, A New Way to Pay Old Debts, A New Trick to Cheat the Devil. There's a whole series of these plays that use these words in a way they hadn't done before. As proper names, these titles perform a trick of their own. They condense the rangy complexity of dramatic action, everything that happens across a stage over the course of hours, into a graspable and possessable form. They represent a marketing strategy, to be sure, but one that's in dialogue, I think, with this heady circulation of practical techniques outside the theater at the same time. And it's one that I think takes a pretty canny approach to the kind of wave-particle duality that we've been seeing with Knack. Is it an action or is it an object? The theater, a temporal experience that you buy, is going to be both. So with their suggestion of small forms, the magic and pleasure of these titles follows from that efficiency of scale, that you can grasp it, you can capture it. In their continuity with household goods, like knickknacks, and in the density of their sound, I think both trick and knack capture that especially well. It is a kind of synecdoche, it minimizes it here. A play that is a knack is promising knacks within, right? It is a knack made up of knacks. And that titular trick then here, right, this is a knack to know an honest man, is a lesson in miniature and a demonstration. So that structure itself suggests emulation, that someone will come to the theater and learn this knack, be able to repeat the knack elsewhere, right? That it's going to teach you something, just as that chickpea trick wins ever more chickpeas. But the trick and knacks that entitle these early modern comedies are further promising that that material form represents something of value in itself. That is, that if you come here, we will give you something new, something you haven't seen before. And that's something that does turn there on the revelation of technique. We have a secret that you don't have yet. You'll come and you'll see it. Like books of household practice from the same period, they're offering their consumers secret, useful knowledge.
Jessica introduces three material examples, a pamphlet and two theater plays. The pamphlet with the title The Trial of True Friendship or the Perfect Mirror Whereby to Discern a Trusty Friend from a Flattering Parasite was published in 1596. The two plays are from 1594 and 1596. What follows is a brief contextualization of the printing history of these materials, showing that the knack actually became a selling point at this particular time.
So in 1596, this pamphlet's published. The only places that the word knack appears are on the title page, A Knack to Know a Knave from an Honest Man, and in this header at the first section. So The Trial of True Friendship or A Knack to Know a Knave from an Honest Man. It doesn't appear anywhere else in the text. This suggests, I think it's most likely that the printer, who's Valentine Sims, who's someone who printed a lot of playbooks in the same period, is the one who added this language. So he read the pamphlet, he thought, what's the takeaway here? It's a knack. I'm going to use that essentially as the kind of cover image as a kind of hook to say, here's the thing that can really grab you about this. And it's doing that in dialogue with that play from 2 years earlier, with the other play that comes out at the same time, right? A knack becomes a selling point at this moment in the 1590s. And it's in imagining that pamphlet as a sellable commodity that Sims introduces this theatrical illusion. A knack in these examples is something shared, it's something offered, it's a product clearly of value to its producers and to its potential consumers, and it promises those consumers useful knowledge. But it doesn't quite promise them a science. And this is where I want to sort of start to think more about what kind of entities are NACs. Instead, the NACs that figure in the plays that I'm about to discuss briefly emerge in a kind of middle space of generalization and instrumentality. They're not totally abstract or absolute measures or rules, but they're also not radically idiosyncratic personal possessions. They can travel between people, and they fall, like Lorraine Destin's account of the model as a kind of rule, somewhere in between, in a middle space of emulation and iteration. The NAC always includes that secondary promise of how to get it. And in this sense, there may be something distinctly early modern. I'm eager to discuss how to historicize this more with all of you. But there may be something distinctively early modern about how their teaching and repetition suggests imitation and emulation. This also seems to me distinct from Nye's argument and consonant with Dastin's argument about the decline of the model as a kind of rule in the modern era. That is, I think, one way to think about how the knack and the trick might be historically distinct from the gimmick. So calling something a knack suggests its prior exclusivity. It doesn't belong to everyone, but it might soon belong to you. It's been held privately or secretly by an individual or by a community. Every knack is someone's knack, but it's also potentially reclaimable, repeatable. It's always potentially your knack, too. This is the promise that drives the title of this pair of comedies. These plays have very little to do with each other. A Knack to Know a Knave and A Knack to Know an Honest Man. Beyond these two titles, the first one, A Knack to Know a Knave, is set in 10th century England. The other is set in 16th century Venice. And beyond, they each have moralizing figures at the center, sort of allegorical figures who help the play fulfill that promise of the knack. In the first, it's an allegorical figure called Honesty, who essentially runs around playing tricks on everyone. In the second play, there's a knave who sort of undergoes a conversion experience after thinking he's killed someone, ends up in a cave where he meets a hermit, rechristens himself under the name Penitent Experience and introduces himself as such, and then goes around basically being like a total drag and really annoying to everyone, but moralizing to everyone about what all of their behavior means and what they should be doing. So whether Honesty or Penitent Experience, the knacks are being sort of taught and enacted by these allegorical figures. They may have been acted by the same actor, in fact, across two different stage companies. That's open to debate. But clearly the latter play is capitalizing on the popularity of the first, and both are harping on these scenes of revelation and discovery. In the first case, especially of vice, Honesty is going around telling everyone how horrible they are or showing their vices, revealing them to people. In the second one, more broadly, the allegorical figure of Penitent Experience is revealing flaws of character. The comedies are promising to lay bare that method to their audiences. And they both do it repeatedly, which is part of what I think is interesting here. They have a kind of cascade of scenes of knack revealing. So A Knack to Know an Honest Man works especially hard to keep the audience from forgetting the title of the play. Variations on that title are proclaimed in different circumstances throughout the whole course of the play. At different points, here's a knack to know an honest lady. Here's a knack to know an errant knave. Why, here's a knack to know an honest man. Right? And they always have this immediate deictic function. Here's a knack, you've just seen it. Right? They're referring back to what's happening on stage. And as the play approaches the end, the promise of a knack for knowing is finally held out to the audience. Here, too, let's measure knacks to find out honest men. Measuring a knack is itself an interesting thing, right? It suggests you're being given a kind of yardstick or litmus test to take with you from the play. It ends with this couplet that I think is trying to say you've really gotten your money's worth here. So henceforth, where'er this history is heard, the world shall praise thee in whose life began the perfect knack to know an honest man, right? Everyone is going to praise you, Penitent Experience, for teaching us all of this, for being the origin of this perfect knack to know an honest man. So there is a sense that the audience, they give you a list of qualities that you can leave with a kind of checklist. I'm going to compare the people I meet to this and see if they fit it. It's not totally usable. Right? I think that's something that we always have to think about when we're reading practical literature of any kind. It's especially questionable whether these stage comedies actually provide usable knowledge, but they're offering it in some way. They're at least putting the sheen on it, performing that they're offering you something. So this is a place, though, where the two comedies converge. There's something kind of empty or inert about Nax in An Act to Know an Honest Man. He's pointing at things that happen on stage. In An Act to Know a Knave, though, the play is much more interested in the Nax as an active procedure and intervention. It's interested in the sort of device or method that honesty uses to find out knavery. These are Nax that intervene in the world around them. And the play, in turn, is a series of setups and stratagems. To paraphrase Francis Bacon, the nature of the knave in the first Nax play reveals itself only when it's under constraint and vexed, right? It's a kind of active experiment that makes it produce something. As the counselor Dunstan says to the king in this play, for many times such simple men bring that to pass the wiser heads cannot attain to. And here he is talking about this figure honesty. For doubtless he hath some device in hand whereby to find such subtle knavery, to make something invisible visible, to bring something into the world that hadn't been there. The promise is that there's one simple trick to do this, some device in hand that could root out that subtlety. The Nax itself here, though, is itself a kind of subtlety. And in both of these plays, the allegorical figures at the center verge into knavery themselves. And part of, I think, the logic of the Nax is that it does take one to know one, right? You have to approach being the knave in order to know the knave well enough to reveal the knave. This is something that does get compared to other sciences at different points. It becomes a kind of discipline of its own, an art, right? He's saying honesty, he's saying, I have a Nax to know a knave. He compares it to, are you some physician or skilled in physiognomy or palmistry or astronomy? Because there are no stars to know a knave. He's saying, right, it's not a system. But honesty sort of shows us that it is a system that can be taught over the course of the play. And he's going to teach us that. And the same logic holds in the pamphlet, where it becomes a trial. People are put under trial in order to see if they are a trustworthy friend or not. The Nax to know a knave there is compared to being able to test the metal of gold. There's a moment there where the author of the pamphlet writes that his readers might want to verify it with a probatum of their own, where probatum there is the word that you would write in the margins of a recipe book in order to say, I've tried this one. So he's using the language of domestic knowledge to show what a knack is there too. Like the pamphlet, the play is offering a kind of promise of a procedure to take home. Though it's doing it aspirationally, and I think we can, again, think more about just how much is takeable, learnable from these as methods. A theater scholar, Jeremy Lopez, has argued that the apparently powerful appeal of the Nax at this moment, and very few people have written about these plays, they're by the broad standards of early modern English drama, like not very good or widely read, but he has written about them, and he's argued that the apparently powerful appeal of the Nax at this moment follows from its embodied performance, the spectacle of the theater passing judgment, that you want to see it happening in person. And I think that's true, but I think a focus on the sort of the knackness of the Nax, that it's promising also not just the Nax, but how to get it, asks us to think more broadly about mechanism, about causality, about procedure, and about technique, that these Nax to know are not only stage events that happen at one moment, but kinds of know-how that are at least open to or potentially repeated elsewhere. Part of the notable singularity of the gentleman with the chickpea is the potential dispersal of the chickpea, that it could be performed somewhere else, picked up by somewhere else. And I think that is part of the promise of the Nax as a small form. I'm going to stop there. I'm very eager to talk to you about all of this. Thank you for sitting through some weird early modern drama on the way.
This was a commented recording of Jessica Rosenberg's lecture on the theory of the Nax. For diving even deeper into the early modern realm of cookbooks, magic tricks, and how to get them, we provided some image material on our website. This episode was the first part of a double feature dedicated to Jessica Rosenberg's research. A second part will be released next month. For this, we left the premises of our university and escaped the inner city's summer heat, taking Jessica on a field trip to the Botanical Garden. thank you for listening.
This episode was moderated by Marvin Rennfahrt. Together with Marie van Bömmel, he developed its concept and script. Johann Gartlinger and Marie van Bömmel were in charge of the editing.
Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs. Literatur und Wissensgeschichte kleiner Formen.